On first impulse, the word conscience seems most easily defined as the innate knowledge of right and wrong. But if we think about the term more deeply, problems quickly arise. Often, for instance, what one group defines as right is readily dismissed by another as wrong. Now, MacArthur Fellow and author of Touching a Nerve, Patricia Churchland, believes that to understand morality, we must first understand the brain. She writes about this in her new book, Conscience, The Origins of Moral Intuition. Patricia Churchland is Professor Emerita of Philosophy at the University of California, San Diego, and the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to the roundtable this morning. Patricia, thank you very much for being with us.
A delight to talk to you.
How did you come to the decision to really explore the conscience and really give it a thorough definition?
It's a good question, because for a long time as a philosopher, I thought that moral philosophy was just too complicated, and I couldn't see any real connection to psychology or to neuroscience. But eventually all that changed. And it changed largely because we began to understand much more about the evolution of the mammalian brain. And because the people who study animal behavior, both in captivity and in the wild, saw many social behaviors in other primates, but also in rodents, in wolves, that resembled in very deep ways things that humans do as part of their social behavior, that is, forming communities, helping each other, providing consolation, sharing food, and so forth. And it seemed to me that there really has to be then a link that is partly genetic and partly learned, but a link that joins all mammals in this kind of sociality that takes different forms in different mammalian species, and in us takes a very specific form.
For those of our listeners who don't know about your background, you are founder of Neurophilosophy, this pursuit that explores the interplay between neuroscientific studies and philosophical ideas about the mind. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of this, let me just ask you of why for so long those had been such separate pursuits.
Well, I think there is actually a very good reason, and it had to do with the fact that it's really, really hard to study the brain. The bits and pieces, the cells are very, very tiny, and you have to have very high tech in order to access them and find out what they do, and to find out that they communicate with each other and that connectivity in the brain is the all-important thing. Now, we couldn't really do very much in neuroscience until there was a mature chemistry and a mature physics. And once that happened, and once engineers and neuroscientists began to develop tools using physics and chemistry to explore the brain, we began to get real ideas about how psychological things that we know about, like learning and memory, how that connects to real structures in the physical brain.
And
bear in mind, that was really, really only came into, you know, real fruition, this development in neuroscience, in the 20th century. So it had to be new.
The book is Conscience, and can we use the words conscience and morality interchangeably?
Well, up to a point, I suppose, but, you know, many words that we're very comfortable with and that we use all the time do not have really precise definitions. So I think that I think of our conscience as the disposition within the brain that depends on emotion, depends on problem solving, on memories for past events, that motivates us to do certain things that involve helping other people, often at a cost to ourselves. And I think morality is very, very closely related to that. Now, I'm sure there are philosophers who would want to make 29 very, you know, precise distinctions between the two. But for most purposes, I'm very comfortable just talking in this normal, regular, casual way.
So talking in a normal, casual way, let me say that it seems that we are hardwired to have a conscience and to worry and to feel and connect with other people, feel for and connect with other people.
There certainly is a very, very powerful disposition that we can call an instinct that babies are born with. And that flourishes depending on whether the babies are nurtured and loved and are part of a family, part of a community. So the environmental conditions play a very important role in the development of this social understanding or this social instinct of humans, as it does, of course, in all mammals and in all birds, I may say. What we are hardwired for is not sort of obeying a specific rule, such as don't tell a lie. What we're hardwired for is to be attached to others, to feel empathy for the suffering of especially of those to whom we are attached, and to be motivated to want to do something. Now, the specific form that motivation results in depends quite a lot on how the child learns to navigate the social world, learns about the expectations of others, and so forth.
As you say in the book, enter brain chemistry, and when that is introduced into the equation, our principles may not be as rational and logical as they would seem.
Well, you might put it that way, I guess. It's just that these very powerful feelings of attachment and bonding, especially between members of the family and especially between parents and offspring, they are not lightly to be disregarded, nor are the feelings of needing to belong to a community. It's important for the mental and the physical health of humans that they have some sort of community, some sort of group to which they belong, and a sense of the trust of others or the trustworthiness of others in that community, and the idea that others will help you and you will help them and that you like each other. And it's a very important function of our social brain. Now, there are philosophers who think that, you know, the community shouldn't really matter, but the fact is it matters tremendously to our mental and physical health.
Patricia Churchland is the author of Conscience, The Origins of Moral Intuition. So back to that idea of brain chemistry, what role does that have then?
There are many, of course, it's a complicated story, but there is a simple part of that story that gives us a clue as to how this works. And the simple part of the story has to do with the neurochemical oxytocin. And that is released in the brain of mothers when the baby is born. It's released in the brain of the baby as it is cuddled and suckled. And it is very important for the development of attachment. That is the sense that this is part of me. That is when the mother sort of looks at the baby and nurses the baby, this is kind of like part of me. And of course, until the baby was born, it actually was. So just as the mother rat, for example, sees to her own warmth and food and safety, so she sees to the warmth and food and safety of her offspring. And this sort of kind of caring, where you are motivated to care about the safety of some other individual, is also seen in mates, in kin, and in friends. But of course, there are variations across species and also within a species.
And our conscience, you write, is significantly impacted by our environment.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is. It's significantly impacted by the genes that sort of prepare the infant brain to be part of a social world. And depending on the nature of that social world, as well as the resilience of the infant and accidental things that may or may not happen to it, a conscience will develop. And the child will become part of the social community into which it is born. And that's an essential, important, not a trivial part of how a child develops and grows up to be a moral human being.
How do you think we should process this information? In other words, knowing more about our conscience should allow us to do what with that information?
Yes, that's a wonderful question, as I've asked myself too. I thought, you know, why would anybody care about this? And I do reflect on that in the book, and the answer is that there isn't a very particular direct way in which this has an impact on specific moral problems, like should old growth forests be maintained or cut down. But I think what it does do is reminds us when we feel tremendous certainty and arrogance about our own moral system, it reminds us that, you know, maybe we ought to just be a wee bit humble, a wee bit cautious, and realize that many of our very deep convictions are either part of our genetic heritage or they are what we learned growing up in the community. And it may motivate us to think about some of them, is that really the way to go here? So I think it's important, especially perhaps in the communities that we have now in North America, where people are at, to be very certain, very arrogant, very demanding about the rightness of their own position. And I mean, as you know, Confucius said, humility is the founding virtue. And I think that this perspective invites us to have some humility, and surely that's a good thing.
If we don't like what our conscience is telling us, how much power do we have to change it?
Well, you know, I think that we have some, but one thing that is pretty clear is that a moral precept that you have lived by as a child and an adolescent, for example, it may change as you become an adult, but it will change slowly. So that if somebody gives you a single argument, for example, it may not change your mind at all. So let me take an example. We have seen, of course, in my lifetime, and perhaps yours as well, a huge change in attitudes towards homosexuality.
Right.
And that didn't happen simply because of a single argument. It happened slowly. It happened as people realized that their cousin or their brother or their sister was gay. And so I think that experience and reflection and understanding is required. Nobody changes their mind about a really significant major social issue as a result of a single argument that a philosopher trots out. It just doesn't happen that way. And maybe that's, you know, a kind of inertial force that evolved in the brain because it is a kind of safety measure. I recount in an earlier book about a grandmother I had who changed her mind rather abruptly. So she announced one day that she was a communist, and it was all about communism and blah, blah, blah. And then about a month later, it turned out that she had discovered Mormonism, and she decided that was much better. And now she was a wholly convinced Mormon. And then it was, then she discovered that Jehovah's Witnesses really were her thing. Now, you know, She was a rather disturbed individual. But I think we all recognize that changing your mind on that scale with regard to attitudes that are really very deep is probably unwise. So I think it's not surprising that by and large humans come to think about certain issues that are very deep rather slowly, and they come to a new view rather slowly.
So scientifically, and I hesitate at this because I don't want to make the discussion overtly political, but scientifically, if we are surrounded by a time and a culture that is allowing behavior that previously had not been as socially accepted, and there is great concern that that behavior is becoming normalized, there is scientific evidence that indeed, at least if I'm reading your book correctly, that it makes sense that that becomes normalized.
Yes, I think it does make sense. And often we're not really aware consciously that the norms around us are shifting, and that our own norms and our own expectations are shifting with them. And I provide that wonderful example, actually, of the experiment from the Montague Lab. But there are other psychological experiments that show a similar thing. And the other example here, I think, has to do with fashion. Now, this is a trivial example relative to sort of deep moral issues. But it is interesting to me how fashions can change over, let's say, the period of 5 years. And something that I would have cheerfully worn 5 years ago, I look at now and I think, oh, my God, I can't be, you know, I can't show up in that. And but it wasn't because I carefully thought it through. It's because the norms around me changed. What I saw in magazines, what I saw on the internet, what I saw other people wearing changed. And I didn't sit down and carefully work it out. I just sort of realized that my closet had stuff that I couldn't wear anymore. And other norms that are not so trivial as fashion changed that way as well. So it's a very interesting phenomenon.
Patricia Churchland is the author of Conscience, The Origins of Moral Intuition. The book is published by Norton. Patricia, thank you so much for joining us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Conscience, The Origins of Moral Intuition. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.